Okay, hi. I'm going to start the lecture. I'm Emma Mason. I don't think you've probably seen me before. And I'm going to be talking to you for 4 weeks on shocks and sympathies. So if you go onto the Modes of Reading website, there's a little link to the lectures where you'll be able to download the handouts from if you haven't got one or if you forget it or lose it. And where for week 7, you can download the piece I'll be discussing then, which is Viktor Shklovsky's Artist Technique. So there's a little link there, and you can click, and it'll be a Word document, and you can download it. And that's what you've got to read for week 7. I'm going to talk about Ginsberg's Howl for all of the weeks that I'm lecturing on. I'm going to talk mainly about part 1 today, and then go on to talk about 2 and 3 in weeks 7 and 8. We've got this reading week in between, which is interesting. But anyway, so I guess this module is about different modes of reading, which you've been looking at. And I'm going to sort of carry on questioning this idea of what texts mean and how like we make them mean as literary critics. And I guess that this might seem quite straightforward to us as readers because we're sort of used to, and especially those of you who've done A-level and the baccalaureate, you're sort of used to reading texts as if they might mean lots of things. But this is not always the case in literary criticism, as you'll come to see when you start reading books from the 19th century, where you've got all of these kind of big-bearded Victorian authors like Charles Dickens, even George Eliot, just got a nice little bit of ruff on her chin there, if you look at the photos, Anthony Trollope. Those sorts of figures really believe that the author rules. What the author says goes. And we'll come on to talk about how in the 20th century that sort of becomes a little bit different. But I think that what we're saying here is that the interpretation moves from the author to the reader. And so the impetus becomes on us to sort of create the text. And I think you've probably had quite a few lectures about how we do this, how as literary critics we become sort of like little magicians. We're conjuring the text into meaning. Now, I'm going to be talking about like a lot of different thinkers over the next few weeks, but the central ones are the ones that you'll have been given on your in the packs. You'll have been sort of told what essays to read. So these central figures that I'm going to be talking about, Shklovsky, Foucault, Barthes, Iser. Unfortunately, all of these people are foreign, and so you can never really spell or pronounce their names, but you don't need to worry about that until you get to them. Now, reading, as I'm sort of going to argue in this lecture, is an act that represents the world to us in all of these different ways. And I suppose that becomes a political act for literary theorists because it shifts the way in which we think and feel about the world as well as about the text. So if we're forced to read the text in a different way, we're forced to read the world around us in a different way. And again, you probably had lots of kind of people telling you that the world is a text, and we read the world as a text. And that's sort of why literary criticism is important. And I think particularly for people that were reading for these 4 lectures, and especially for Ginsberg, reading is supposed to create an epiphany within us. It's supposed to wake us up a bit, which we need, given that it's 10 a.m., which is practically the middle of the night for me, I think. I'm not very happy about this hour, but anyway, we'll move on from that. I forgot this is being recorded, isn't it? No, dear. Anyway, so, yes, the reading creates this epiphany about our world, which is forcing us to challenge the problems within it, the inequalities, the constant inequalities that are between black and white, rich and poor, gay and straight, men and women, etc. Ideas that just continue on. There was a moment in the 70s where everybody got really political about these ideas, and then it's almost as if we've kind of solved them now in the 21st century, and obviously we haven't. They've just sort of got worse. We've forgotten about them. And that's why it's really important to read Ginsberg. Now, the interesting thing about Ginsberg is that he also understands that reading can distract you from politics. So as much as it wakes you up to politics, reading can also act as a kind of shock absorber, which allows you to kind of ponder on the problems in the world without being able to kind of act on them. So we sort of become wrapped up in the novel or the the poem or the play and get distracted from the real world. So we can go into the seminar, and we can say a load of Marxist things, and then we can just go home and buy a load of stuff on Amazon. And then we can sort of put these two different identities, where Marxists in the classroom with sort of capitalist bourgeois outside, and then it sort of feels okay. And Ginsburg's very aware that reading can kind of distract us from political action, and it's sort of trying to force us out of that by writing this kind of poetry that mirrors reality in some way. And ironically, it's the stuff that you're going to read throughout your degree that is the most unrealistic, that will most realistically represent your world. Realism never represents the world. Realism is never very realistic. All those Victorian novels where the narrator's turning around to you and saying, "Reader, I married him," or, you know, those kind of turns to the reader are not realistic. Whereas the kind of language that you get in Howl, where you've got this kind of these sentences that go on and on and are kind of constantly sort of fragmented, that is the way we think, that is the way we talk. We very rarely talk in a kind of completely articulate, syntax-perfect way. So I want us to think about the way in which Ginsburg kind of shapes and uses language and the ways in which he forces us to kind of have a particular response. Now, against this way of using literature to wake us up to the world is an idea called ideology. You know, you've done ideology, right? Somebody say yes. Sorry? They don't talk? You don't talk? Really? No one wants to talk? It's 10 o'clock, I guess. Well, 9:15 now. That's like 2 a.m. in student terms, I suppose. Okay, so there's no talking. Okay, well, they've done ideology, right, Cassia? Okay, good. So you know what ideology is. It's a word that's going to keep coming up throughout your degree. It's a word that means any set of beliefs or ideas that become dominant at a particular period of time in history. So ideology is not fixed, it changes. The dominant ideology at the moment is democratic capitalism. You know, that's the dominant idea, right? That we all should kind of get on and be equal, but that we should all really succeed and have a lot of money at the same time. So it's democratic capitalism, or it's liberal capitalism, if you like. That wasn't always the ideology. There wasn't always a kind of point in time where everybody wanted to kind of have a big house and get married and buy a Jag. There was times where not having money was kind of seen as sort of better or the ideology at the time. But against ideology, Ginsburg posits reading as a sort of subversive practice. Now, Ginsburg thinks reading is subversive because he is a sort of Marxist figure in a way. And obviously, as you know from your lectures on Marxism, ideology is a very threatening idea because Marxists think that norms aren't shaped naturally, but they're always shaped by people in power. They're always shaped by the people with the most amount of money. And so however much capitalism kind of fails us in this world, and it has failed us endlessly, most recently last year with the recession, etc., we still want it, right? So those idiot bankers, as soon as the crash happens, they just kind of keep gambling all their money away. Because there's a sort of an addiction to ideology that you can't somehow get out of it. It's very difficult to get outside of dominant ideas and beliefs because you can't really challenge them, is what Marxists are sort of saying. And really, Ginsburg, and particularly a lot of the figures that come before him, like Viktor Shklovsky, who we're going to look at in week 7, who's a Russian formalist, he thinks that literature does at least provide us a space to think radically about ideology, even if we can't get out of it. Now, Shklovsky says that the most useful kind of literature in helping us to get out of ideology is poetry, and that's what Ginsburg thinks as well, and that's what I think too. Not that I'm putting myself on the same level as Shklovsky and Ginsburg in any kind of means. I'm much more intelligent than either of them. Poetry is a space where you can kind of think about language in a way that you can't in prose or drama. Now, that's what I think. That's what Shklovsky thinks. That's not what everybody's going to think on your degree. You know, lots of tutors are going to tell you lots of different things, but I'm going to make an argument to you today, sort of using Howl, about how there's something about the physical space of the poem, about the form of the poem, that allows you to sort of fill in the blanks yourself, that allows meanings to arise rather than sort of to push you to understand a kind of shared set of meanings. So, for example, everyone sort of knows the plot of Pride and Prejudice, right, by Jane Austen. We've all kind of got an agreed sense of what that might mean. We might dislike or like different characters in that book, but we sort of know what the story is. We might have an agreement about that. I don't think we can have the same sort of agreement about a lot of poems, particularly not Howl. We don't really know what this poem's about. I hope you've all read it. It's quite weird, as you all have seen. But I think it's particularly trying to be weird in order, again, to sort of challenge us and sort of snap us out of normative ways of thinking. Now, on your handouts, I've given you a little lecture plan. So you can see there at the top, poetry and ideology. I've done that bit now. Now I'm doing the beat poets, which is the next bit of the lecture. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Ginsberg's sort of involvement within this movement called the beat poets, the beat poets. Now, they're a very good example of poets who embrace poetry as a countercultural form. I would say that there's two kind of big groups of poets that use poetry as a kind of countercultural form to politically radicalize society. The Romantics and the Beat Poets. And you'll do the Romantics next year if you go on to take Romantic and Victorian poetry. And obviously I'll talk shortly about the Romantics' influence on the Beat Poets. Now, mainstream American poetry in the 1950s and 60s was, and by mainstream I mean all these people who are sort of like writing creative writing in literary groups and sort of sitting around in universities trying to sort of write poetry. Most of those kind of the poems that are produced in America are trying to copy T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot is the kind of forceful, foremost figure of poetics in the period. Eliot and the other figure would be W.H. Auden, who's obviously a British poet but has an immense influence in America at the time. They're both arguably quite conservative in their politics. And I say conservative like that in a really irritating way because, for the purposes of the tape, I'm raising my hands and making square quotes. It's not a tape, is it? That shows that I'm really old, that I've just said it's a tape. Anyway, moving on, because it's being recorded. Eliot and Auden are conservative poets. You can do radical readings of their poetry, of course. You can kind of make them radical, but as kind of thinkers themselves, biographically, they're quite conservative. So in the 1950s, you get a series of younger American poets who want to make a new kind of poetry and radicalize poetry and make a sort of a poetry for America. The problem with T.S. Eliot is he's constantly going on about references from other cultures. The wasteland filled with references to classicism, to foreign literature, to English literature. You know, the American poets who are kind of rising up in the 50s say, we don't want this kind of poetry. We want a poetry that reflects our own country. And the main kind of figures behind this drive are people like William Carlos Williams and Gertrude Stein and H.D., those kind of names will kind of keep coming up when you read about the beat poets. Now, William Carlos Williams, very important figure. He wrote the little introduction, if you've got this little copy of Howl. A fabulous poet who sort of really influences Ginsberg and helps him sort of get on his feet. And I suppose the two main prominent members of the avant-garde movement that we call the beat poets are Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. Jack Kerouac, who most of you will have come across before. Now, why are they called the beat poets? I've put that on your handout so that you've got a little reference there. Three different ways in which we can think about the word beat, or why those poets chose the word beat to describe themselves. The first one is that obviously it signifies the beat of the poem itself. It alerts us to the fact that they are poets, and that they're not writing a different kind of literature. And specifically, they're using the jazz beat. That's the kind of particular beat that they're trying to mimic in their poetry. Jazz, which is also sort of growing up in the 1920s and 30s, a big influence on these poets. And critics, literary critics of the beat poets of that time, call beat poetry typewriter jazz. So it's kind of the sense of translating that kind of like bebop rhythm of jazz into language. And if you've listened to jazz, which obviously you have, you know that it's kind of full of these abrupt syncopated sort of rhythms where different instruments come in and they move about in often unrhythmic ways and stop the rhythm and change the rhythm. And that's why critics called beat poetry typewriter jazz. Secondly, the word beat has a social, psychological, and political meaning to signify the kind of beaten-down position of the outsider, of the kind of marginalized figure from society, someone who's unable to conform to ideology. What happens if you can't conform to ideology? It doesn't mean you just sort of don't conform to it. It means you're stuck within it. What happens if you don't want to be a democratic capitalist at the moment? Nothing. You just get called a hippie, and then everyone just thinks you're a little bit weird. So the kind of sense that somebody is beaten down, dispossessed, alienated, that's the kind of identity that Ginsberg is interested in, because he himself is one of those figures, as I'll come on to talk about. Third, the word beat has a spiritual meaning, and I think this is very important to Ginsberg. You can hear the word beatitude in beat, that sense of a kind of spiritual beautifulness, sort of blessedness and visionariness. Certainly, you know, Ginsberg is interested in this idea of angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection. There's loads and loads of references to the Bible and how the Bible is all over how that kind of sense of the Bible giving us a kind of visionary experience that is equivalent to that of drugs. That's what Ginsberg's kind of interested in, as are the Romantics, which I'll come back to. So the Bible is being interpreted by people like Ginsberg as a sort of radical form, not necessarily a conservative one, which we might think it is. I don't know what you think. So I've put a little quote on your handouts from Ginsberg where, in an interview where he's talking about the Book of Moses. I think he's talking about the Pentateuch, the five books of the Bible, which Moses narrates. And Ginsberg says, the only poetic tradition is the voice out of the burning bush. The only poetic tradition is the voice out of the burning bush, which means that the beat poets understand poetry as being like the Bible. And what is the Bible to them? It's prophetic, it's apocalyptic, it's powerful, it's endlessly interpretable, and it refuses to have one story. It's the first ever book that has the same story from loads of different perspectives. You know, the Gospels, it's the same story, but they're completely contradictory. They are completely contradictory texts, and yet they tell the same story. And it's the first book that is a series of books that's written from a million different perspectives and all shoved into one thing together and endlessly translated. And that's sort of what, again, that the beat poets are interested in, pushing different genres together. The other thing that we might say about the Bible is that it is poetry. Theologians who use the Hebrew text of the Bible read it as poetry. If you read it in the Hebrew, it reads as poetry. It's only in the English translation that the sort of people that were translating it into English in the 17th century, primarily in the 19th century, want to make it into a story. They want to make it easier for us to read. So they translate the Bible out of poetry. But really, when you go back to the sort of original Hebrew, it is poetry. And there's something about poetry, the beats thing, that opens the world up to personal understanding. I think that's very important. I want to kind of give you a little reference from a book called The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, who's also a kind of beat writer. And you should definitely YouTube, Aldous Huxley and Doors of Perception. And you can see Huxley taking a load of drugs and having a sort of out-of-body experience. It's quite funny. I'm not advocating drugs in any way. Don't do drugs for the purposes of the tape. Now, what Huxley says is that literature kind of becomes, for him, very stifling when it's put into universities. Because what happens when people start reading it in universities is that they want it as a kind to be, this code to be cracked. They want to get an answer out of it. They want to write an essay. They want to write a 2,000-word essay with an answer at the end of it describing a poem. Now, finding rhythms and scanning poetry, you know, where you find all these different ideas in there, different ions, trochees, all that kind of thing. I'll come back to that in week 7 or probably 8. That kind of reading can be very useful, but it's not useful if it scares you away from the poem and stops you from kind of having a personal reading of it. And I just want to quote a little bit from The Doors of Perception, where Huxley is trying to think about why education is always going to be conservative, how if it doesn't stop trying to kind of solve problems and fix things and think about things in a narrative way where there's an absolute definite answer at the end of it, how it's not going to be useful. This is Huxley. In a world where education is predominantly verbal, highly educated people, that's us, find it all but impossible to pay serious attention to anything but words and notions. There is always money for, there are always doctorates in, the learned foolery of research into what, for scholars, is the all-important problem. Who influenced whom to say what and when? That's a little dig against doing historical readings of poems where you just kind of plough the poem for a bit of history and ignore the fact that it's a literary text. Huxley again. Even in this age of technology, talking about the 50s, but kind of works now, the verbal humanities are honoured. The non-verbal humanities, the arts of being directly aware of the given facts of our existence, are almost completely ignored. A catalogue, a bibliography, a definitive edition of a third-rate versifier's ipsa prima verba, a stupendous index to end all indexes. Any genuinely Alexandrian project is sure of approval and financial support. But when it comes to finding out how you and I, our children and our grandchildren, may become more perceptive, more intensely aware of inward and outward reality, more open to the spirit, less apt by psychological malpractices to make ourselves physically ill, no really respectable person in any really respectable university or church will do anything about it. He's trying to say, you know, when we read literature, all we want to do is make it fit a kind of box. We want to make it mean something. We don't want to think about how it might help us as readers. And after all, for these writers in the 50s, we as readers are creating the meaning. So we are important to it. And what's the point of having literature if there aren't readers to have it? And he's saying that in his generation, and it's the same is true now, that the biggest illness in the West, the biggest illness in the West, and it has been since the 1950s, is depression. And he's saying that literature has the power to cure people of that, to snap people out of that. But we're not interested in doing that. We just want to make literature mean and write nice lots of indexes of like things about, you know, how many dogs were on stage when somebody performed some play in the 17th century. That kind of archival research, Huxley says, is crushing poetry's ability to communicate things like the spirit, emotions, immaterial things that we can't touch to us. Now, all the beat poets are interested, not only in this idea of finding out who or what we are, but they want to prove that this is an important question. They want to kind of give us an answer to say to like engineers and lawyers when they're like, why are you doing English literature? Because you like reading. You know, and they think that they're doing something really important and vocational. The beats want to give us an answer to why literature is important. And specifically, they want to kind of argue that poetry is important in an age that's completely dominated by two questions, making money and making bombs. Those are the two questions that dominate 1950s and 60s America. The advertising industry is just huge in 1950s America. And this is where I fully recommend that you go and watch Mad Men. I get a little bit annoyed with students at Warwick sometimes because they don't seem to watch very much TV. I think you should all stop reading so much and start watching a lot more television because none of my references make any sense anymore because everyone's too busy reading books. So go and read Mad Men. It's a very interesting kind of exploration of the advertising industry in New York in the 1950s and 60s. And the main figure, Don Draper, is your typical tortured beat poet-like figure. He is completely ideologically normative. He's this guy with a family, with a house. He's very rich. He's very perfect. But he can't sustain it. He doesn't know what it means. He keeps doing it, but he doesn't know what it means. So he keeps going and having affairs and doing ridiculous things all the time because he doesn't understand what it means to have this kind of normative identity. He doesn't know why he's doing it, even though he does keep on doing it. He doesn't seem to recognize that it's ideology motivating that. And it's to the beat poets that he turns when he's having a crisis, specifically to a book called Meditations in an Emergency, Meditations in an Emergency by Frank O'Hara, which is on your handouts. And I just want us to kind of have a little listen to Don reading this bit of the poem, because I think he does it sort of quite nicely.
Now I am quietly waiting for the catastrophe of my personality to seem beautiful again, and interesting, and modern. The country is gray and brown, white, and trees. Snows and skies of laughter are always diminishing. Less light, not just darker, not just gray. It may be the coldest day of the year. What does he think of that? I mean, what do I? And if I do, perhaps I am myself again.
Don May is sort of pictured in a very kind of suburban bit of America. You can see the sort of tension between what he's reading and this suburban background that he has. And that question in that last bit of the poem, it may be the coldest day of the year. What does he think of that? I mean, what do I? That phrase, what do I, that's the most important bit of the poem that he's quoting from. But if we gave that to English grammar specialist, it wouldn't make any sense. What do I doesn't make any sense, and yet it's the most important bit of the poem. And often when we're reading the beat poets, it's the bits that are the most tricky and the most ungrammatical and the bits that seem to make the least sense, which you have to kind of pick upon and draw out. Now I want to turn to Ginsberg now and just talk a little bit about his background before we go on to Howl. I'm not going to do a load of biographical reading because I know you can just go and look it all up on Wikipedia anyway, but there's a couple of points that are important to think about. Firstly, that he grows up on the East Coast in New Jersey. He's the son of a poet, Lewis Ginsberg, and also the son of Naomi Ginsberg, who's a radical communist and nudist. And Naomi Ginsberg is quite a strange kind of figure. So he's got this kind of poet figure in his father, who's also a teacher, quite sort of stable literary figure, and this mother who goes insane in his early childhood. So her nudism sort of leads into this insanity. And a lot of her episodes at home are very frightening to Ginsberg. And a lot of the experiences of madness that he translates into his poetry are from his experience with his mother. And he turns to literature as a way out of these experiences. And he particularly turns to the poetry of Walt Whitman, who's sort of the sort of great father figure of American poetry. And particularly for Ginsberg, it's Whitman's kind of homosexual imagery that he's most interested in Whitman's kind of gay poetry. He then goes to Columbia University, meets Jack Kerouac, does a bit of studying, but he gets suspended for like doing some naughty drugs and things. And he decides to embrace this identity of being a kind of gay beat poet. He goes and moves to New York. He starts cruising around gay bars in Greenwich Village, doing lots of drugs. And he joins this new community of poets and visionaries and drug takers, which all to him feel like these very kind of joyful crazy people, as opposed to the kind of depressive craziness he sees in his mother. There's a little bit from Howell that I put in your handouts. All of these figures that he's with seem to him like people who were expelled from the academies for crazy and publishing obscene odes on the windows of the skull, who cowered in unshaven rooms in underwear, burning their money in waste baskets and listening to the terror through the wall. That sort of sense of all these people coming together and throwing their money away and rejecting the capitalist society that's grown up around them. Now, these fellow artists, as I say, become increasingly interesting when set against the problems of his mother, who ends up being lobotomized. And this is sort of a very traumatic moment for Ginsberg. And you can see that in this way that Ginsberg is sort of struggling between the kind of joyful craziness of the beat poet aesthetic and the kind of psychological craziness of his mother. And I think that the turning point for Blake, kind of the way that he gets out of that crisis, is by turning to the romantic poet William Blake. Now, you may have come across Blake before. You might have read The Songs of Innocence and Experience. But really, Blake is himself a very Ginsbergian figure. They're very similar in their kind of politics. Blake also accused of treason in the 18th century for shouting "Damn" with the king at a rally in London. And his way of writing poetry, Blake's way of writing poetry, it also earned him these labels of insanity and disease. So everyone says, oh, Blake's a madman, because he writes this kind of weird poetry. Here's a little bit from The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which I haven't put in your handouts. You'll do it next year, hopefully. He says, this is a poem, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. As I was walking among the fires of hell, delighted with the enjoyments of genius, which to angels look like torment and insanity, I collected some of their proverbs, thinking that as the sayings used in a nation mark its character, so the proverbs of hell show the nature of infernal wisdom better than any description of buildings or garments. When I came home, I saw a mighty devil folded in black clouds and with corroding fires. He wrote, how do you know that every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight closed by your senses five? Now, I'm not expecting you to be able to like write that down. I am wanting you to hear the same kind of rhythms in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell as you get in Howl. That sort of slight tip into prose, but still retaining the poetic text, the kind of radicalness of that poetic text. Now, Ginsberg says that he has a specific moment where he wakes up to Blake's poetry when he's reading Blake in 1948, and he's actually on the bed in his apartment in Harlem, and he's having a little bit of fun in his pants while reading Blake, and this is what he says. This is his description of what he's doing. So anyway, what I had been doing that week, I'd been in a very solitary state, dark night of the soul, sort of, reading St. John of the Cross, maybe on account of that everybody had gone away that I knew. I was graduating from school and had nowhere to go and the difficulty of getting a job. So finally, there was nothing for me to do except eat vegetables and live in Harlem. So in that state of therefore of hopelessness or dead end, change of phase, you know, growing up, I came with a Blake book on my lap and suddenly heard a very deep, earthen, grave voice in the room, which I immediately assumed, I didn't think twice, was Blake's voice. What I was seeing was a visionary thing. It was lightness in my body. My body suddenly felt light. And a sense of cosmic consciousness, vibrations, understanding, awe, and wonder, and surprise. And it was a sudden awakening into a totally deeper, real universe than I'd been existing in. So anyway, there I was in my bed in Harlem, jacking off with my pants open, lying around on a bed by the windowsill, looking out into the cornices of Harlem and the sky above. And there were a couple of girls living next door, and I crawled down to the fire escape and tapped on their window and said, I've seen God! And they banged the window shut. Oh, what tales I could have told them if they'd let me in. There's a message to you all. If you get some naked people tapping on your windows in the middle of the night saying that you've seen God, let them in. Oh, the experiences you will have. Now, even Ginsberg reacted against the intensity of this experience. It freaked him out. And he goes straight for a bit. He kind of gets a girlfriend, admits himself into an insane asylum to cure him of his gayness. But this obviously doesn't last very long because it's ridiculous. And he decides that he's going to move to San Francisco. And the reason that he wakens up to the idea of his homosexuality is because he meets this figure, Carl Solomon, who is in Hell. And Carl Solomon is a schizophrenic who he meets while he's in the kind of asylum that he's gone into to cure himself. And he realizes that he doesn't need to be there at all because of Carl Solomon. And then he moves to San Francisco and meets his boyfriend, Peter Orlovsky. And I put a couple of pictures on them on the handouts. Aren't they cute there? There's them in their little early days, all naked together, being beat poets and hanging out. Ginsberg's the one with a really nice long beard. I'll choose that way to differentiate them for now. And then there's when they get a little bit older. They're together for a very long time, for sort of 30 years. And that relationship really allows Ginsberg to kind of have the stability to continue to sort of write his poetry. Now, why have I given you all this biographical information? Because we don't really need it to read Hell, but I think it's interesting for three reasons. Firstly, because it reminds us that Ginsberg is purposely writing in a mad, non-normative way, partly as a way of dealing with real insanity around him. So you can't really accuse him of playing around or trivializing insanity, because he's got this real mad mother figure that he's trying to deal with. Secondly, it reminds us that Ginsberg is always an outsider. Even when he's straight, he's still Jewish. Even when he's gay, he's always sort of constantly trying to fight for a kind of place in society. And in some ways, Ginsberg is bisexual. And that identity is even less kind of acceptable because, you know, what are you? What are you doing with this identity? Is it just because you want loads of choice? There's all this kind of prejudice against that identity that he's trying to deal with. It would have been much easier if he'd have just been straightforwardly gay at that time. So he's dealing constantly with this idea of being an outsider in society. The third reason I wanted to mention it is because of the importance of Blake. And Blake, I'll keep coming back to, has been very significant in the influence that he has on Hal. Now, what's our timing? Let's go straight to Hal now to kind of have a think about the way in which the Beats are responding to the alienating social and ideological structure of their society through this poetry. Now, what Ginsberg's trying to do is to reinterpret Blake's radicalized interpretation of Christianity to radicalize his own society. Now, let me just say a little bit more about that. What Blake does, what Blake's kind of main innovation is in his poetry, is to say Christianity seems to be either really positive to some people or really negative to other people. Whereas, in fact, it's neither positive or negative. It's got both elements in there. And that's what makes it a really interesting theology. And Blake himself tries to kind of reject the Old Testament idea of the Bible as being one of law and dogma and embrace a kind of New Testament Christianity, which fundamentally, for Blake, teaches him to embrace a compassionate practice. In the figure of Jesus, he sees a figure that is pure compassion. But centrally for Blake, the reason that the figure of Jesus Christ is so compassionate is because he's imaginative. That's the key thing for Blake, that Jesus is imaginative. And that's also the key thing for Ginsberg, that somehow these kind of angelic figures that populate Hell have got a kind of imagination that comes from opening up yourself into the kind of immortal and eternal worlds that Jesus offers. And I put a little quote on your handouts from Jerusalem, Blake's long poem, Jerusalem, just right at the bottom there. He says that Christianity can open the eternal world to open the immortalizing man inwards into the world of thought, into eternity. Well, what does that mean? It just simply means that there are kind of other worlds out there, not like kind of, you know, Star Trek other worlds, kind of other imaginative spaces within us that we can explore by kind of pushing ourselves through literature. And for Blake, he says that Jesus is always able to do this because he's always thinking imaginatively. He never tells anybody what to do. He always does it through a kind of weird sort of story or a poem, a parable or describing a miracle. Those things never really make sense. That's the point of them, is that you have to kind of go and interpret them yourself. So Blake does not read as an end in itself, but as a means to an end. And this way of reading is what Ginsberg wants to do. Now, in 1955, Ginsberg read the whole of Howl out in a place called the Six Gallery, the Six Gallery in San Francisco. And this was a very kind of important moment for the Beats. It was completely different from the kind of formal academic readings that were then, and are still, I think, the norm on college and university campuses. The gallery that he was in was actually a kind of old auto repair shop that they just sort of fitted out to kind of do this reading in. And when Ginsberg read Howl, Jack Kerouac came along, and at the end of every line, Kerouac would shout, "Go!" like that at the end of every line. We could do that, couldn't we? But we won't, because Cathy says you won't speak. So that's not going to work. And I'm not going to do it because it'll be ridiculous. But I'm just going to have you hear a little bit of Ginsberg reading Howl, because he's got such a fabulous voice.
Howl for Carl Solomon. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night.
Go.
Who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz. Who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs illuminated. Who passed through universities with radiant, cool eyes, hallucinating Arkansas and Blake-like tragedy among the scholars of war. Who were expelled from the academies for crazy and publishing obscene odes on the windows of the skull. Who cowered in unshaven rooms in underwear, burning their money in waste baskets and listening to the terror through the wall. Who got busted in their pubic beards returning through Laredo with a belt of marijuana for New York. Who ate fire in paint hotels or drank turpentine in Paradise Alley, death. Or purgatoried their torsos night after night with dreams, with drugs, with waking nightmares, alcohol and cock and endless balls.
Oh, I think we should stop it there before I get sacked. Giving you lewd material. The striking thing about the way in which Ginsberg reads it, and you can listen to the whole poem, and I definitely would listen to this particular site. I've put in the link on your handouts, because you can hear the whole poem, part two and part three. And he's brilliant. He really sustains the kind of mood. And what's particularly good, I think, about hearing it loud is that you can hear the audience laughing. It's funny. It's funny. How's it supposed to be funny? There are bits in it where, you know, he's talking about kind of taking his underwear off and, you know, cocks and balls being holy. And he's screaming all these different words about solitude and faith and visionariness. And it's supposed to be funny. But Ginsberg reads it in a particular way that both makes it sound amusing, but also brings out the sounds of it, the rhymes of it. And that's what's really important, that it's poetry, but that he's still using traditional forms. This kind of form is very sort of similar to the forms that you see in the Bible. And you can hear those rhymes. Who passed through universities with radiant cool eyes, hallucinating Arkansas and Blake-like tragedy among the scholars of war. And he reads it like that so that you can hear all those rhymes. And when it was published, readers were amazed by this poem. They were really shocked by it, really because of its stark presentation of contemporary urban life, as you can see in the poem. And it's kind of synthesis of a sort of surrealism, visionariness, Christian perspective, Jewish perspective, and political polemic. In 1957, however, a few months after the actual book publication of Howl, which is by was published by the City Lights Press, which is a radical press in San Francisco, which is still there. You can go and visit it. The publisher of Howl and City Lights Books were accused of obscenity. And I put the spelling of the publisher just on your handouts. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, that's the publisher's name. That's just on the underneath lecture plan there. And they had to go to court to defend the book against obscenity. And the obscenity trials, of course, were brilliant for advertising the book. They bought national attention to Ginsberg and to the City Lights bookstore and made it into kind of a pilgrimage. And in a way, it was the obscenity trials that made the Beats a kind of movement because it kind of brought them so much into perspective. Now, in the end, Ferlinghetti defended Ginsberg's poetry against the charge of obscenity by saying that it wasn't the poem that was obscene, it was the reader for finding it obscene. Well, if you've read it in a rude way, reader, that's your problem. And of course, it's very interesting if you compare it to kind of the treason trials that Blake was kind of prosecuted under too, because the same kind of logic was used to defend Blake. In the 18th century, the law stated that if you imagined the death of the king, could be prosecuted for treason, even if you imagined the death of the king. But in order for the prosecutor to imagine that you've imagined the death of the king, he's then imagined the death of the king. So then he's going to be prosecuted as well. And that's exactly what happens here. The judge has to let the book off, right? Because otherwise he would be accused of being obscene himself. So what the judge finally rules is that, yes, he agrees that it's full of coarse and vulgar language. That's his words. And unorthodox and controversial ideas. But it has redeeming social importance. That's what the judge says. So the book gets off. Now, there's several lines throughout the poems that I'm sure you'll be sort of concentrating on in your seminars that do pick up on specific events that I've kind of talked about. I guess lines like super communist pamphlets being spread in Union Square, whoring through Colorado in myriad stolen night cars, all that stuff about saintly motorcyclists doing things to each other. In those kind of lines are references to real events that are happening at the time, specifically an event called McCarthyism. And I'll just finish the lecture by just saying a couple of words about McCarthyism. Joseph McCarthy, a US senator from Wisconsin, who was put in charge of trying to rid America of communism in a kind of post-World War II era. And McCarthy's very famous for starting a series of witch hunts against anybody that seemed even slightly subversive or to the left of center, and branded a lot of artists communists. So there's a sense in which Ginsberg's just kind of flouting that and saying, I don't even care what these rules are. I'm going to write a poem about communism and about super communist pamphlets being spread around in Union Square. The point, remember, is not whether these words are offensive to you or not. Ginsberg doesn't really care about that. What he cares about is that you understand how innovatively arranged they are for the time, that he constantly is shocking us, not really with his content, but with the structure and with the syntax and the way in which he fuses words that might not necessarily go together. Angel-headed hipster, hot rod Golgotha, jail solitude watch, hydrogen jukebox, Bob Caballah. They're words that come from massively different traditions, from jazz, from Christianity, from language about nuclear weaponry to kind of instruments to play music on. He's shoving all of these effects of sound together to produce this kind of sense of very strong imagery and the sense of a poet who has a sort of very strong imagination. And again, he's not trying to sort of put himself above you as readers by saying, look at all these fantastic images that I can kind of come up with. He's putting you on the level with him to kind of force you to sort of come up with your own meanings by reading it through. And I guess that's what we'll kind of come on to when I'll go on to kind of discuss the figure of Moloch in the lecture in week 7, who is the sort of star of part 2 of the poem. And that's when I'll be talking about Victor Shklovsky's work too and how that kind of has a big influence on the beat poets at that time. Okay.